Welcome. I'm glad you're here. This is Orthodoxy by G.K. Chesterton, using the Project Gutenberg edition, read slowly, aloud, and in company. These readings aren't lectures, and they aren't explanations. They're an invitation to listen carefully, to follow an argument that wanders on purpose, and to allow surprise to do some of the work. So let's take our time and see where Chesterton leads us today. Last time we contemplated the sanity of useless things and the madness of extreme logic. Today we walk with Chesterton as he moves from the logic seated in insanity to the razor point logic of materialism. Chesterton invites us to consider two contrasting views of the expansiveness of the universe. The first is purely a set of laws that govern all matter and equalize it not into the multiple dimensions of science fiction, but the blandness of wash, rinse, and repeat of an endless number of galaxies that are only a variation on a theme, a small universe indeed. Or, like the mind that created science fiction itself, is the humble blue speck of our Earth in a way larger than the cosmos it exists in. Can the whole of something really be greater than the sum of its parts? With that tension in mind, let's listen to Chesterton.
Reading 4, lines 492 through 614 of Chesterton, G.K. Orthodoxy, 1908, Project Gutenberg, ebook number 16,769. Nevertheless, he is wrong. But if we attempt to trace his error in exact terms, we shall not find it quite so easy as we had supposed. Perhaps the nearest we can get to expressing it is to say this, that his mind moves in a perfect but narrow circle. A small circle is quite as infinite as a large circle, but though it is quite as infinite, it is not so large. In the same way, the insane explanation is quite as complete as the sane one, but it is not so large. A bullet is quite as round as the world, but it is not the world. There is such a thing as a narrow universality. There is such a thing as a small and cramped eternity. You may see it in many modern religions. Now, speaking quite externally and empirically, we may say that the strongest and most unmistakable mark of madness is this combination between a logical completeness and a spiritual contraction. The lunatic's theory explains a large number of things, but it does not explain them in a large way. I mean that if you or I were dealing with a mind that was growing morbid, we should be chiefly concerned not so much to give it arguments as to give it air, to convince it that there was something cleaner and cooler outside the suffocation of a single argument. Suppose, for instance, it were the first case that I took as typical. Suppose it were the case of a man who accused everybody of conspiring against him. If we could express our deepest feelings of protest and appeal against this obsession, I suppose we should say something like this. Oh, I admit that you have your case and have it by heart, and that many things do fit into other things, as you say. I admit that your explanation explains a great deal, but what a great deal it leaves out. Are there no other stories in the world except yours? And are all men busy with your business? Suppose we grant the details. Perhaps when the man in the street did not seem to see you, it was only his cunning. Perhaps when the policeman asked you your name, it was only because he knew it already. But how much happier you would be if you only knew that these people cared nothing about you. How much larger your life would be if yourself could become smaller in it. If you could really look at other men with common curiosity and pleasure. If you could see them walking as they are in their sunny selfishness and their virile indifference, you would begin to be interested in them, because they were not interested in you. You would break out of this tiny and tawdry theater in which your own little plot is always being played, and you would find yourself under a freer sky, in a street full of splendid strangers. Or suppose it were the second case of madness, that of a man who claims the crown, Your impulse would be to answer, "All right. Perhaps you know that you are the King of England. But why do you care? Make one magnificent effort, and you will be a human being and look down on all the kings of the earth." Or it might be the third case, of the madman who called himself Christ. If we said what we felt, we should say, "So you are the creator and redeemer of the world. But what a small world it must be. What a little heaven you must inhabit, with angels no bigger than butterflies. How sad it must be to be God, and an inadequate God. Is there really no life fuller and no love more marvelous than yours? And is it really in your small and painful pity that all flesh must put its faith? How much happier you would be, how much more of you there would be, if the hammer of a higher God could smash your small cosmos, scattering the stars like spangles, and leave you in the open, free like other men, to look up as well as down." And it must be remembered that the most purely practical science does take this view of mental evil. It does not seek to argue with it like a heresy, but simply to snap it like a spell. Neither modern science nor ancient religion believes in complete free thought. Theology rebukes certain thoughts by calling them blasphemous. Science rebukes certain thoughts by calling them morbid. For example, some religious societies discouraged men more or less from thinking about sex. The New Scientific Society definitely discourages men from thinking about death. It is a fact, but it is considered a morbid fact. And in dealing with those whose morbidity has a touch of mania, modern science cares far less for pure logic than a dancing dervish. In these cases, it is not enough that the unhappy man should desire truth. He must desire health. Nothing can save him but a blind hunger for normality, like that of a beast. A man cannot think himself out of mental evil, for it is actually the organ of thought that has become diseased, ungovernable, and, as it were, independent. He can only be saved by will or faith. The moment his mere reason moves, it moves in the old circular rut. He will go round and round his logical circle, just as a man in a third-class carriage on the inner circle will go round and round the inner circle unless he performs the voluntary, vigorous, and mystical act of getting out at Gower Street. Decision is the whole business here. A door must be shut forever. Every remedy is a desperate remedy. Every cure is a miraculous cure. Curing a madman is not arguing with a philosopher. It is casting out a devil. And however quietly doctors and psychologists may go to work in the matter, their attitude is profoundly intolerant, as intolerant as Bloody Mary. Their attitude is really this, that the man must stop thinking if he is to go on living. Their counsel is one of intellectual amputation. If thy head offend thee, cut it off, for it is better not merely to enter the kingdom of heaven as a child, but to enter it as an imbecile, rather than with your whole intellect to be cast into hell, or into Hanwell. Such is the madman of experience. He is commonly a reasoner, frequently a successful reasoner. Doubtless he could be vanquished in mere reason, and the case against him put logically. But it can be put much more precisely, in more general and even aesthetic terms. He is in the clean and well-lit prison of one idea. He is sharpened to one painful point. He is without healthy hesitation and healthy complexity. Now, as I explain in the introduction, I have determined in these early chapters to give not so much a diagram of a doctrine as some pictures of a point of view. And I have described at length my vision of the maniac for this reason, that just as I am affected by the maniac, so I am affected by most modern thinkers. That unmistakable mood or note that I hear from Hanwell, I hear also from half the chairs of science and seats of learning today. And most of the mad doctors are mad doctors in more senses than one. They all have exactly that combination we have noted. The combination of an expansive and exhaustive reason with a contracted common sense. They are universal only in the sense that they take one thin explanation and carry it very far. But a pattern can stretch forever and still be a small pattern. They see a chessboard white on black, and if the universe is paved with it, it is still white on black. Like the lunatic, they cannot alter their standpoint. They cannot make a mental effort and suddenly see it black on white. Take first the more obvious case of materialism. As an explanation of the world, materialism has a sort of insane simplicity. It has just the quality of the madman's argument. We have at once the sense of it covering everything and the sense of it leaving everything out. Contemplate some able and sincere materialist, as, for instance, Mr. McCabe, and you will have exactly this unique sensation. He understands everything, and everything does not seem worth understanding. His cosmos may be complete in every rivet and cogwheel, but still, his cosmos is smaller than our world. Somehow his scheme, like the lucid scheme of the madman, seems unconscious of the alien energies and the large indifference of the earth. It is not thinking of the real things of the earth, of fighting peoples or proud mothers, or first love or fear upon the sea. The earth is so very large, and the cosmos is so very small. The cosmos is about the smallest hole that a man can hide his head in.
Fractals. I remember a time when fractals were the in thing. A fractal is a pattern that repeats itself at different scales. If you zoom in, you see a smaller version of the same structure. This is called self-similarity. Big or small, the pattern is the same, seemingly to infinity. In the 1990s, the hunt was on to find that pattern almost everywhere. Fractals even became the stuff of art. I could not help but think of fractals when I read this section of Orthodoxy. As Chesterton compares the logic of the mentally challenged to that of the materialist, is he suggesting that the large universe, the small cosmos, and the case of materialism share the same kind of pattern? A pattern of thought that simply repeats itself at different scales, a mind that is complete but small, consistent but closed. Does this mean that humanity's ingenuity is not ultimately found in the ability to analyze structure in minute detail? Is it possible to understand every part and still miss the whole? Or is our expansiveness found somewhere else, in the refusal to stop at logic alone, in the courage to imagine purpose, meaning, and creative expansion beyond the pattern? Next time, we consider how rigid materialism, like madness, may explain a great deal, yet leave so much of the human experience out of the picture that life itself can begin to feel like a closed system, complete perhaps, but strangely unsatisfying. Let's meet again in a couple of weeks. Until then, God bless and be well.